I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, we talk with Amor Towles, best-selling novelist of Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow, The Lincoln Highway, and most recently, Table for Two, a collection of six short stories. His novels have collectively sold millions of copies and have been translated into more than 35 languages. He joins us today from his home in New York. Amor Towles, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks for having me back.
I devoured The Lincoln Highway, and apparently so did many readers, including those who reviewed it and called it a novel that would become a classic. I got to thinking about that term, the great American novel, and again, I probably Googled more during reading your book, The Lincoln Highway, than I've ever Googled in my life while reading a novel, because there was so many interesting things I had to dig into. One of them was this. As I thought about your novel, I thought, well, why can't Amor's novel be on the great American novel list? And it was John William DeForest who coined that term, and he said that a great American novel paints the American soul and captures the ordinary emotions and manners of the American existence. And I would argue that that is exactly what The Lincoln Highway does. The first question is, did you look at it that way, or did you have any idea when you were writing this where this thing was going to go?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm a planner. So long before I sit down to write the first chapter of a novel, I've spent years thinking about it, designing it, filling notebooks with sort of imagining through the story, what happens, where it happens, who it happens to. So I know a lot about a book before I begin it. But when I finish one novel and I'm preparing to start my next project, I usually have a couple of different things to choose from. And having finished A Gentleman in Moscow and sort of looking across the ideas that I had been developing over the years and asking myself, what do I want to do next? I immediately wanted to do The Lincoln Highway. And I think that in part of it is for what you're pointing at, having just spent 4 years writing about, a Russian figure about sort of comes from the European aristocracy and is going through turbulent political times in Russia. There was a desire and a great pleasure in returning back to America, of course, where I am from, and exploring it and with an American sensibility. So and I think that kind of magnified to some degree instead of it simply being a story about individuals at a particular time and in a particular neighborhood, it increased the desire to sort of bring in all of America into the narrative in a sort of a way of great scope.
Mm-hmm. Well, boy, you really did that. I'm from Missouri, but I lived most of my life until I got out here in Idaho, in Illinois, and I have family in Nebraska. I went to school in Kansas. I know this Midwest pretty well, and you've nailed it. And I guess the next question is, do you travel around before you write this stuff? I mean, there's a lot in here that you would need to know. I guess you can get it on Google, but man, it seems like a road trip would really do the trick.
Yeah, the specific answer is I did not. I'm not a research-driven writer. So uh-huh. What I try to do instead is to write books about things that I feel comfortable imagining. And so I had not spent very much time in Russia when I wrote Gentleman in Moscow, but I had spent decades reading Russian literature and reading about Russian culture and history. And that was the foundation I used to invent that work.
Yeah.
Similarly, in The Lincoln Highway, that book opens up in Nebraska. I had never been to Nebraska in my life. I had never been on the Lincoln Highway in my life when I wrote that book. When I finished A Gentleman in Moscow, I flew to Russia, moved into the Metropole Hotel where I had never stayed, and revised the book while actually being there. And so I'll often do that. I'll postpone the research till after the imagination has done its job.
Yeah.
In the case of Lincoln Highway, same thing. I finished the first draft and I boarded a plane. I flew out to Nebraska. I went to a small town in the center of Nebraska, rented a car, and began driving east on the Lincoln Highway, just as the characters did. Right. And I like to do that. I like to postpone, and I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, but I like to postpone that sort of physical research component or that sort of that investigation, as it were, until after I've had the chance to imagine the story in its full detail. I don't want the research process to interfere with the invention of the characters in a way that is that feels organic within the story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say that I like to write things where I have some sort of grounding. And the grounding for me in terms of the Midwest is that my father was from St. Louis.
Oh,
so I was raised, okay. I was raised in Boston.
Yeah.
But as a boy, I was in St. Louis, you know, every year at some point. And you know, so I have, sort of, you know, a feel for a Midwestern sensibility, really probably, you know, from my father, my grandmother, my aunt, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in St. Louis, so I can relate to that. Oh, you mentioned the Lincoln Highway, the name of the book. Let's help our listeners understand it. Tell us about the Lincoln Highway, how it ran and why Lincoln and the works.
Sure. The Lincoln Highway is an historical road. Most Americans have never heard of it. But in the early 20th century, there were no highways that crossed the United States. All the roads were basically local roads that had sort of developed over time from the local needs. And an American entrepreneur who had made a fortune in the automotive industry decided that there should be a highway that crossed the country. And the federal government had no interest in road building at the time, so he decided to do it himself. And he raised money and he built this highway, the first highway across the United States. And it begins at Times Square in New York City. It ends in San Francisco, overlooking the Pacific Ocean and Lincoln Park. And in the aftermath of its construction, it was the most famous road in America by far. Before it was built, very few Americans would cross the country by car. I mean, it would be a few hundred a year. And within a decade of the Lincoln Highway being completed, more than 30,000 Americans would cross the country by car in a given year. So it really sort of changed the way that people sort of lived and moved across the United States. And then that kind of built from there to ultimately the American highway system, which gets built in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this is being done back in, you know, closer to 1915.
Right.
So anyway, the Lincoln Highway exists now today because of the American highway system that was built under in the 50s. The Lincoln Highway is sort of became obsolete, but it's still there. You can still drive from Times Square to San Francisco on the Lincoln Highway. It is generally with one lane going in either direction. It takes you through very small towns across the Midwest and the Northwest. And so it's sort of an American monument, as a way, to this slower period of American history.
Right.
And, and so the characters do travel on this highway on their way from Nebraska to New York City.
Right. Yeah, well, in a sense, you know, Route 66, everybody knows about that. I'm glad somebody brought the Lincoln Highway to the fore, because that's exactly what your novel does. Why set it in 1954?
You know, when you come up with an idea for a story, when I come up with an idea for a story, you have an idea that could be at any time, could be in any place. And mm-hmm. so you're sort of asking yourself, where does this story belong? And this story opens, for those of your listeners who haven't read it, opens where a young man who as a high school student, he killed a fellow student accidentally, but he was sent away to a juvenile prison for a couple of years. The story opens the day that he's returning home from the prison to the family farm, being driven by the warden. His father has died in the interim. The farm is in bankruptcy. His younger brother is waiting for him to get home. And he's sort of prepared to start his life anew. But when the warden drives away, it turns out the two other inmates from the juvenile prison have hidden in the warden's car in the trunk and have, you know, come because they have a plan for our hero, Emmett, and sort of have a notion of what Emmett should do next in his life. And that sort of launches the adventure of this story, which only lasts 10 days. That's the way it begins. And that's why the highway becomes important. But why 1950s? With that story, you do it by feel. You know, should mm-hmm. the story be in the 60s, and the 50s, and the 30s? I think in retrospect, the reason that the 50s felt so perfect for me as a time to set the story is it's because when there were all kinds of dynamics that were about to, that were enormous influences of the later part of the 20th century in America, that had just barely begun, but were kind of under the surface. And so quickly, what I'm talking about is things like the fight against racism in the United States, the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement, civil rights has been a fight since the beginning of the nation, of course, but the modern civil rights movement really began because of the Supreme Court decision in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, mm-hmm. which outlawed segregation. So 1954 is sort of a moment where the fight against segregation is sort of brewing. And at that moment, it's about to take off, but you're still kind of in the quiet period before the civil rights movement ramps up over the next decade. You're about to go through the rise of feminism, you know, coming out of the Second World War in the early 50s, there was a very sort of strong American sense of where the woman belonged, you know, in the home, raising children, keeping the house clean, et cetera, et cetera. And that's about to change. You know, there's going to be this building desire over the course of the 50s into the 60s for a new independence for women. The sexual revolution is about to happen. It's beginning in the mid 50s with the launch of Playboy, for instance, in that time. So 54 is sort of this nice moment in American history where these big tumultuous forces are about to come powering through the nation. But there's glimpses of that in 1954, they haven't quite happened yet. And so it's sort of a time that is on the edge of turbulence. And that to me makes it a fun moment in which to tell the story.
Well, it certainly is. You're listening to Amor Towles. He is discussing his novel, The Lincoln Highway, and also his book of readings, Table for Two. And by the way, I have to zero in on the civil rights aspect of your comments there. I wonder if you couldn't share with us my favorite character of the book. Well, that's tough. Billy was also my favorite character. We'll talk about him later. Ulysses.
Yes.
I think that may be the hint you're giving our readers that, there's a change coming, all right, and here's a little kid who's going to find out about it firsthand. Maybe you could explain what happens.
Yeah, the two, Billy, who's 8 years old, Emmett's younger brother, and Emmett, who's 18, they are traveling on a freight train, illicitly, to New York City, because Emmett's two friends have borrowed his car, as it were, and headed off to the city without them. So they're trying to catch up. And Emmett leaves his younger brother alone in an empty freight car and in search of food by sort of walking across the roof of the cars of the train while it's stopped. And while he's alone, he basically meets an African-American who has returned from the Second World War, whose name is Ulysses, and they form a terrific bond. And it stems from the fact that Billy is a lover of adventure stories. He has a book, sort of a compendium of adventure stories. He's read the story of Ulysses, the great mythological character from Homer, and knows the story back and forth. Ulysses, the African-American, has just returned from the war. His family has sort of disappeared in the interim. And so he's sort of traveling the country because his wife was so upset with him that he enlisted in the war and left her and their young child and sort of has moved on without him. And sort of as his own penance, he's traveling the country by train, sort of never stopping. And when Billy meets him, he says, "What's your name?" And the man says, I'm Ulysses. And young Billy says, "I know who you're named for." And the African-American vet says, "Well, of course, everybody knows who I'm named for. I'm named for Ulysses S. Grant, the general who freed the slaves." And Billy says, no, you're named for Ulysses, the great sailor from Greek mythology. And they kind of get in a little of an argument about it. But then Billy describes the history of Ulysses. He says, "Have you been in a war?" "I have been in a war." Did you leave behind a wife and son?" And he said, "I did." And he starts to get spooked that this young boy knows these things about it. And the young boy eventually convinces him that you're not really named after Ulysses S. Grant. You must be named after this figure from history who in the myth ultimately does get reunited with his wife and son, and which has great effect on this vet who's been sort of traveling alone in sorrow. So anyway, the setup is sort of this, here's this young boy and here's this sort of seasoned old black veteran or, reasonably old, and they have a meeting of the minds and in essence form a friendship that all comes about through this one word, Ulysses, which means two different things to the two of them. And through that word and through the storytelling of Ulysses, they form this relationship.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, Ulysses comes to the rescue of Billy, you might say. We'll let the readers figure out how that works out. But a tear came to my eye when I read the part where Billy and Ulysses were going to part for good, and Billy gave Ulysses a gift.
Yes.
The St. Christopher Medal, which, of course, is the medal for travelers. And yeah. I thought, but again, you're the guy that put all this together. That's what's amazing to me. You tell this story as though it really happened, and yet somehow you managed to think of these classical journeys like Ulysses the Greek was on and find a way to work it into this novel. Today I'm speaking with Amor Towles. He's the author of Table for Two, a collection of short stories, and The Lincoln Highway, the latest novel he has written. You do, by the way, in a number of areas in this book, refer to the classics and bring the classics, the Greek classics, into this, and also American classics. I don't know how to ask the question. I guess my question is, how do you do that? I mean, this is an amazing, amazing talent.
Well, thanks, Bob. And the answer to your question, it kind of goes back to the sort of description I was giving earlier of that I do have this sort of multi-year design phase with my work. Mm-hmm. I decide I'm going to tell the story of Lincoln Highway. I'm going to tell the story of this two boys and the two friends and the adventure they have over 10 days. Once I know I want to tell that story, I will spend a few years imagining that story in every detail. So as you say, if I describe those events almost like they happened, it's because in a way that's the way I feel. Because over that multi-year time frame, I'm losing myself in that moment, asking myself, where do they go? What is when they get there, what does that room look like? When they meet this stranger, what is the stranger like? And where does he or she come from? And what is his or her personality? And what are they actually going to talk about and why? And what do they see? And how does that influence them? So I'm asking myself all of these questions as I slowly, over a period of time, imagine the story in greater and greater and greater detail. And then only once I can kind of see the story from beginning to end with clarity, then do I, start the process of beginning to write chapter one. And I think that, every writer has their own approach, and different approaches work for different writers in different ways. This works for me in part because when I'm writing the chapters, I have that clarity of what's going to happen, of where I'm going. And I think that what I found is that all that planning, what it allows me, this is a little counterintuitive, what it allows me to do is to be as poetic as possible when writing the chapter. Because if I don't know what's happening in the chapter and I'm going to write it, I have to spend all my time thinking about, okay, what happened? What's going to happen? Who is this? Where are they from? Where are they talking in? What's the room? You're sort of solving all these technical problems as you are writing the chapter. Mm-hmm. But if I know all those things, I know where it's happening and what's going to happen and what's going to be said, then instead, while I'm writing the chapter, I can kind of lose myself instead and sort of maximize the poetic aspect of writing so that the language is rich, so that their metaphors surprise me in the course of the writing of the scene. There are images that surprise me, things that are said by the characters which surprise me, that sort of come out of my subconscious as I'm sort of fulfilling the plan of the outline.
And it seems as though Billy really takes a lot of what you've just said and puts it into this novel. I learned something about Shakespeare's Macbeth and how he was regarded back in the Bard's day that I never knew. You might want to share that with our listeners. But tell us about Billy in general. He's like an encyclopedia of knowledge. Yeah. And that's why I say I can see how Amor Towles is feeding Billy this information that fits so perfectly into the novel.
I knew from the beginning that there was going to be this central, so the center of it is these three 18-year-olds, the Emmett, who has gone to prison, the two friends from prison who then follow him and then sort of create the circumstances of that forces him on the road. But as you're imagining, right off the bat, as I was imagining Emmett, our hero, your imagination sort of balances without even thinking about it, balances things. So it made sense that I wanted him to have a younger brother with him, an 18-year-old mm-hmm. and an 8-year-old. And one of the advantages of sort of having an 18-year-old and 8-year-old And you know, many of us sort of grew up in households where there might be siblings of that difference, or you might have cousins of that difference, is those are profoundly different moments in life, right? The 18-year-old is on the verge of adulthood, is beginning to make decisions for themselves about how they want to lead their life, about what they think is right and wrong, about what they want to do and who they want to spend their time with, you know, all these sort of decisions that the 18-year-old is suddenly making as he or she enters adulthood. But and part of that is sort of also beginning a sense of understanding how the world works, or at least their version of how the world works. And that may mean they become a little cynical or a little more pragmatic, a little less driven by their own imagination, let's say, as you enter adulthood. Well, so then you have an 8-year-old, and that's a totally different person, right? The 8-year-old exactly. is still wide-eyed, is still learning, is still curious, and in a way that you know, young that children really only children can be. All human beings are curious, but that unique curiosity of the young child is something that is very different than the kind of curiosity we experience in adulthood. So, in imagining the story, it seemed perfect to sort of have this balance, the older sibling, the younger sibling, who are looking at the world in two different ways. And I'm right from the beginning, I knew that Billy would be one of these kids who he sort of digs into things. You know, he's not a savant by any means. You know, he's not a genius or anything like that, but you can have these kids who they fall in love with a book and they read it 30 times. You know, like we've seen, you know, kids who read Harry Potter, you know, over and over and over to the point where they know it all word for word. And that's what Billy is. He's that kind of kid. And he has this compendium of the heroes throughout history and mythological figures and figures from history as well. And he's read it over and over and over and taken in all the information in this compendium. And so he can kind of punch above his weight a little bit. He knows more than you might think he does because of having dedicated his time to reading this book. But at the same time, he's coming to it with great energy and faith and the openness and curiosity in others. And that provides this sort of nice psychological balance to the more seasoned young adults that are in the story.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking what our listeners might be asking next, and I suspect they might want to know, why the journey? Why would these four kids have to get on the highway and head for New York City when, in fact, at least one of them really wants to get to San Francisco? Maybe you can just give our listeners a little bit of the story behind this journey.
Yes, and this is not really a spoiler because it sort of all
right.
plays out in the first chapter, as it were. But the two friends who followed Emmett out of the prison, is hidden in the car of the warden and followed him, they have a very specific plan. One of the two was given some money by his grandfather that has been held in trust and has not ever actually been handed to him, even though he has become of age. And so the third figure, Duchess, has convinced Wooly, who's this sort of the kid who's inherited the money, we should go get the money. Your grandfather gave it to you. It's yours. Let's go get it. And so that's the plan. But what they need is a car. And they're trying to get Emmett to go with them. They think that Duchess is convinced that Emmett's going to love this adventure, and that, you know, they all agree that it's the right thing, that he's going to agree that it's the right thing to do. When Emmett hesitates, Duchess says, okay, we'll go get the money without you. And so he takes Emmett's car without asking and heads east in search of this money. And so Emmett is forced to then follow him on this train with his younger brother in order to catch him and recover the car. And because also there's things in the car that are matter to Emmett. So you end up with this adventure, and they are racing towards New York City, where, of course, they meet up again once they're there on the way towards a summer house where the money has been kept in a safe. So it sort of is this sort of adventure that is unfolding. But I think the bigger, you know, answer to your question is that if you think about the journey, it is the oldest story in Western or really one of the oldest stories in Western culture. You know, if we go back, it's in the Bible is filled with great, you know, with journeys, you know, Moses out of Egypt and the slaves out of Egypt as an example. But if we look at the development of literature, it begins with things like Homer's Odyssey, in which Ulysses is trying to get home after the Trojan War. In the Roman era, we have Virgil's Aeneid. It's one of the greatest works that comes out of that period. And that is also a journey epic in which Aeneas is trying, having lost the War of Troy, to find a new home for his people. in Don Quixote, which many view as the first novel or sort of the precursor to the novel in European culture. That's of course a journey story where Don Quixote and Sancho Panza are traveling across Spain, you know, trying to do good things. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is a journey story. So throughout Western culture, we've had this recurring motif of telling a story of a hero on some kind of journey. And, you know, why is that? Why do we keep returning to these stories? And, you know, why do we get to American literature? And the first great work is Moby Dick. Again, another journey story. And I think it's because narratives, storytellers from very early on understood that the journey is the perfect kind of metaphor for the central goal of storytelling, which is to describe how the individual evolves. All stories, whether novels or narratives or epics or myths, are about the evolution of individuals. You know, they start in one place in their life, they go through experiences, the experiences open their eyes or change the way that they see the world. They take actions which have consequences because of the obstacles that they face. In essence, all human development is for each of us a journey, of course, in a metaphorical sense. So storytellers, I think, began using the physical journey as a way of investigating the change of the individual that we all go through in our lives and describing it in this physical form. So as a storyteller myself, it's great fun to sort of say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to do my own version of this in this tradition, to pick up this physical journey of 1,000 miles over 10 days, but use it as a lens to begin to explore the changes that these young men will go through in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've just explained a little marginal note that I made as I was reading your novel. I said to myself, I spent many years in the college classroom years ago, and I said, we have a foundations course here at Boise State University, and this, your book, a novel, which I'm sure would surprise some of our professors, would be a perfect approach to learning what I guess we used to call the foundational Western civilization course, but yours even expands beyond that. I just think this book is a great textbook for people, young people, trying to find their way and deciding what to do in college.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, now let's get on to Table for Two, because I want to spend a few minutes with this. It's a collection of 6 short stories. They're based in New York City. Well, the first one's not, because that's about Pushkin. And I'm not a student of the Stalinist period of Russian history, so I was very fascinated by the journey. And I must say, just like the Lincoln Highway, it didn't take me more than 2 or 3 pages when I'm all in for Pushkin. I want this guy to make it. And yet he moves out of the country into the city because he didn't make it. And then he gets a job in the city and he doesn't make it there. But then something else develops that I never even thought of before. And I guess the question I would have is this business of standing in line, and you can explain what I'm missing here in the introduction to the question, but is this for real, or is this a part of Amor's ability to think a little beyond history here into how could I make a really interesting short story, which this certainly is.
Yeah, and so as you note, the Table for Two has really got 2 parts. The first half is these 6 stories, which all end up in New York. Pushkin's the sort of a sleight of hand in that it begins in Russia and ends up in New York City. The other 5 are very much set in New York City, mostly around the turn of the millennium, around the year 2000. And then the other half of the book is a long noirish novella called Even Hollywood, which follows the character from Rules of Civility to Hollywood in 1938. For, you know, as I say, sort of a noirish, adventure, for a lack of a better word. But the in terms of the first story, which is Pushkin, which does begin in Russia, it sprang out of the work I was doing when I was writing A Gentleman in Moscow. That book set in Russia. There was a moment when I was writing a scene in which the Count's closest friend, Mishka, has just finished a prison term and has come back to Moscow, and he was formerly in favor of the revolution, but has become sort of a cynic, as it were. And he is seeing the lines that were a part of Russian life at the time, and sort of a cynically observing that this is one of the great inventions of Bolshevism, is that they've, you know, could make a line to, for anything. And so while I was writing that passage, I sort of thought, oh, you know, I wonder if, would it be interesting if there was a person who wasn't really good at anything, but was really good at standing in line, you know? And so, so out of that, I kind of began imagining this personality, this individual who's sort of sincere and kind, but a little hapless, and sort of discovers that he's a good stander in line. People love him when they're next to him in lines. And, the, and this becomes his profession, as it were. He becomes a professional line stander. Now, that's an invention of mine. But as I was beginning to think about this further, one of the things that I thought about was that at this, in the 1930s, you had this interesting moment when there were lines in Russia because of the failures of Bolshevism. You had to wait in line for all kinds of things. But at that moment in time, there were lines in the United States, too, because of the Depression. So you had lines, you know, people lining up outside of banks to get their deposits out. You had people lining up for bread. You had people lining up in the United States outside manufacturing plants, trying to be, you know, chosen that day to be on the crew that does the work. So you had these two great nations, Russia and America, which for very different reasons, suddenly in the 1930s, lines were all across their, each of the countries. And the interesting thing about a line for me is that it's very humanizing, you know, in this sort of paradoxical way. You know, we think of standing in line as dehumanizing in many ways, but it's humanizing in the sense that when we go stand in line, you know, like at the DMV or wherever, the person in front of us and the person behind us, we don't know them. There are equals at that moment. You know, we're there for the same reason. We're on equal footing. We could come from entirely different backgrounds. You know, if you go to a line in America, you could be a different religion, you could be a different race, you could be from a different social class, but you're both going through that line. So you're kind of brought down to the most basic sort of human level. It's these, you know, these two, you know, all the trappings that might separate us are gone. And we're just sort of there side by side, you know, waiting to update our driver's license, what have you. And so I thought, yeah, that's sort of there's something beautiful about the line in a way, as a concept, as frustrating as it might be. So the story grows out of that. That Pushkin, this character who is sort of the perfect line stander, begins in the lines of Russia. He ends up in the lines of America during the Depression. But ultimately, it's about the humanity of the connections that people are making with him as they wait, you know, the strangers to his right and his left.
Exactly. It's just a great story. So can you tell us what's next from my favorite novelist anyway? I'd love to hear what you're working on. I understand if you can't, but...
Yeah, I'll tell you is I began work on a novel when I finished writing The Lincoln Highway, mm-hmm. and I got about a quarter of the way into it when I realized that, or really thought about the fact that two of the characters in that novel, the one I was working on, had appeared in shorter fiction of mine. And so that's why I decided to set that aside and write Table for Two, because I wanted my readers to have the ability to meet these two characters in the shorter stories that they appear in before they meet them in the novel. So with Table for Two, when it came out in April, I shifted my gears back to this other novel. And that novel begins in Cairo at the end of the Second World War. And then it ends in New York City in 1999. And as I say, two of the characters from Table for Two will appear in that novel, but that's about all that I will tell you.
Well, that's a great teaser of that next novel, and we certainly understand why you don't want to give anything more away, but believe me, we'll be standing in line waiting for Amor Towles' next novel. It's been great having you at Reader's Corner, and we look forward to having you again when you get out of Cairo.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.